Welcome back for the third hour of Issues Etc. Tomorrow on the program, the doctrine of justification. Pastor Eric Rotman of Good News Magazine will be our guest. We'll also do a little holiday movie review with Hollywood screenwriter Brian Gidawa. That's tomorrow on Issues Etc. For the remaining half hour, we're going to talk about just war theory. Dr. Daryl Charles, visiting fellow at the Institute for Faith and Learning at Baylor University, is our guest. He's associate professor of religion and philosophy at Taylor University, and he's author of the forthcoming book, The Just War Tradition and Its Contemporary Relevance. He's also written an article for the recent edition of Touchstone Magazine titled Between Pacifism and Jihad, The Just War Tradition Theory. Dr. Charles, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
You have written that just war theory, as it is classically articulated in Christian theology, is grounded in Christian realism. What do you mean by that?
Well, here we take our cues from the fathers of the church, whether ancient, medieval, or modern. And by that, I'm talking about what, for example, the fathers Ambrose and Augustine would have said was the duty of Christian charity or neighbor love. That is, we protect an innocent third party in the face of evil. It was interesting that Ambrose and Augustine both refused self-defense. That is, they were pacifists at the level of self-defense. However, when it comes to a third party being introduced into the situation, that changes the moral equation entirely. So while they were willing to abdicate self-defense, they required defending an innocent third party as an expression of Christian charity. And it seems to me the Christian theologians in the mainstream, in line with Ambrose and Augustine, understand that in a fallen world, at times we may need to actively confront evil, not always, but when it's a case of assault on another as opposed to an insult, which would be aimed at us. So Scripture enjoins us to endure evil individually when it comes to persecution or when it comes to insults, but it does not enjoin us to stand by passively when a third party is suffering grievous injustice. Then we have to wrestle with just cause, right intention, and standing in harm's way. Policemen, it seems to me, do this all the time. Forget about Christian theology for the moment. Policemen and firemen do this all the time. They enter into, for our good, for the protection of culture, harm's way, even to the expense sometimes of people's lives. So there is something that may be required, not always, Todd, but it may be required in a situation. And therefore, Christian theology can see it as an expression of Christian charity, neighbor love, that is, when an innocent third party is entered into the moral equation.
So we have as the basic foundation for any just war theory that would fit in the classical model the acknowledgement that we find ourselves in a fallen world, that we have the duty to do good where we are able to do good, and that the solutions that we arrive at will not always be neat and tidy. It's a messy
exactly.
business.
That's exactly right. I spent 5 years working in criminal justice research before I entered the classroom in the mid to late 90s. I was doing criminal justice research on Capitol Hill, and I was constantly aware of the fact that there weren't many evangelically minded Christians down there working. There were some, but not a lot. And I often wondered, why is that? Where are the people working in this messy middle? I like the way you described it there. The just war tradition, just as the criminal justice system, is predicated on wrestling with and identifying moral criteria that help us avoid two, what I would call, twin errors. On the one hand, we avoid absolute pacifism, that is, the mindset that says force is never justifiable as a moral enterprise, but we also want to avoid the other extreme, which is, let's call it political realism or militarism, or in religious garb, that would be jihad or crusade mentality, which always and can always in all circumstances justify force or killing. It seems to me that the answer is not force or war are never legitimate options, nor they're always. Rather, the answer is somewhere in the middle. It's messy. We have to wrestle with it. And the just war tradition helps us through its identification of criteria to wrestle with this messy middle to determine whether or not to apply it, whether or not to go, and then once we're there, how do we proceed using moral guidelines.
I'd like to talk about three prerequisite ideas that really need to be laid out before we talk about just war. Before we do that, there is a presumption popularly in American culture that says, look, the use of military force is going to be assumed to be immoral in some sense in every case in and of itself. Is that borne out by the traditional teaching of the church on war?
Well, it's not. Now, we must be fair to say that there has always been, Todd, there have always been two strands, particularly in the early church. We find the pacifist strain strong early on, but we also find those who were serving in the Roman legions. And so very often there's this tendency to paint the early church as only pacifist. And fairly, it's important to say that, yes, early Christians did struggle with military service and soldiering because of military oaths that would have to be made to the emperor. And so idolatry for them was an ever constant problem. The two main pacifist church fathers, Tertullian and Origen, are concerned about that, but neither of them denied that Christians were serving in the Roman legions. At a popular level today, it seems to me there are several reasons why there is this strong anti-war or pacifist strain in American thinking. I mean, part of that is rooted in our national history. The last 50 years, for example, consider the way, even though World War II was considered just, consider the way that ended with our firebombing of parts of Germany and dropping bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. How about our national experience in Vietnam, which was a uniformly negative experience for many, or the nuclear age with the ability of weapons of mass destruction? Very often people assume because of the extensive nature and the power and the destructive force of the weapons of today, warfare or force cannot ever be a legitimate enterprise. And then I would say there are distortions about how we define peace. For many, peace is the absence of conflict. And I would say, well, no, there can be an unjust peace. And so we have to define peace. And true peace, it seems to me, is ordered by justice. Augustine understood it that way. He described it as tranquillitas ordinis, that is, a justly ordered peace.
Let's talk about justice. In particular, one of the things you highlight as prerequisite to a discussion of just war theory, and that is the non-fluid nature of justice. What do you mean?
Yes, given our cultural climate, Todd, in which the very notion of justice is so prostituted, we basically have to purge terms of other cultural usage and try to understand them in a non-fluid way. So that's what I'm trying to do in the article, and that's what I would argue. Justice must give an account of what is. Historically, in both pre-Christian philosophy as well as in Christian philosophy, justice is that which is due others. So let's say you and I, we have a disagreement on the street. What is just? Well, it depends. Either it depends on how we define it, or justice must be something that's unchanging, that must be something rooted in natural moral law. So you have all these various competing notions of what justice is, but for the centuries and millennia before us, justice was indeed not fluid. That is, it was stable. It was standard. It is that which is due others. It seems to me that the language of justice that we find in the Bible, and especially strong in the Old Testament, conveys that. We are to do justice. That is, our social relations are supposed to reflect a certain ordering and a valuing of human life. Why? Well, because the Creator, from whom and in whom we know justice, deals that way. So Christian theology and Christian philosophy must proceed on the basis that justice is something that's non-fluid, that it doesn't change with time, cultural circumstance. Otherwise, we have what postmodern contemporary culture would have it, and that is justice is what you conceive of it and what I conceive of it, so that one man's mugging is another man's good time. And so this, it seems to me, is the role of the church and Christian philosophy and theology to stand up and say, and redefine terms in their classical and non-changing way.
And we've heard that little axiom repeated in a different form, and that is one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter.
Well said. And this is why then we have to really redefine our terms before we can even talk about just war, can't we? That the idea of just war, first of all, I want to be honest and say that there's no such thing as a just war. But more accurately, we would speak of it as a justified war. That is, what criteria would inform us and help us justify using force or not, whether not to, and then once we're in, how do we proceed? So it seems to me how we define justice is going to determine what we mean by just war or not just war.
Now, in interest of time, you have said justice then may be defined as the capacity to fulfill one's moral duties both privately and publicly. It is a moral condition of right relations within society. What then is the relationship of justice to the Christian concept of love for neighbor?
Very often, Todd, in Christian thinking, at least this has been my experience, love and justice are held in opposition to one another. Don't we often find that, well, if we're going to be loving, then we have to be compassionate or we have to be merciful? Well, that's true to a certain extent. But it seems to me the Apostle Paul unites the two when he says, I think it's somewhere in Ephesians, speaking the truth in love, we so on and so forth. That is to say, true love, agape love, God's love, will always honor what is true and what is just. That is, it won't compromise truth just to be quote-unquote loving or compassionate. But on the other end, justice will always seek to do something in a right, redemptive, morally ordered way. I mean, those of us who are parents struggle with this tension constantly. I do not show my children justice to the expense of loving them, but I don't demonstrate love to them to the expense of justice. And hopefully a justly ordered society, and I realize there is no society that's perfectly justly ordered, but in our feeble, human, frail, sinful attempts to order justice, we try to keep them together. So love and truth, love and justice, justice and mercy are not opposites. Rather, they are two sides to the same ethical coin.
Luther once wrote a little tract called Can a Soldier Be Saved? And he answered the question not so much of just war, but in terms of vocation. Yes, it is a godly vocation to serve as a soldier, and the soldier may have to find himself in a moral quandary deeper than many of us find ourselves in, especially with the issue of taking life or meeting out death.
That's right. That's right. It's interesting you bring up Luther, because he was caught within competing currents, wasn't he? On the one hand, he had to deal with the popes who were constantly wanting to crusade and were willing to offer indulgences for those who would go. On the other hand, he had to deal with the peasants, for example. Consider the peasant revolt, Todd. Here are people who were inspired by his message. These were Protestant-oriented people who were very open to and sympathetic to his message. And what does he argue? The revolt must be put down by the authorities. So Luther, we could probably see differing strands of thought in Luther, but Luther, along with Calvin and the other reformers, has a very high view of the authorities. I don't think it's uncritical. He was critical of the authorities, but he understood that monk and magistrate are equal in the sight of God, and monk and magistrate have the same, shall we say, sacred calling. So there is no sacred and secular dichotomy in Luther. Rather, they're all the same. They all can serve God. And for Luther, one could even serve as a soldier and do it out of love for God. And the reason for that, in his view, is that you would seek to protect the social good. I like that.
Dr. Daryl Charles is our guest, visiting fellow at the Institute for Faith and Learning at Baylor University. We're talking about just war theory. Let's talk a bit, if we could, about Romans chapter 13, which is often read out of context with Romans chapter 12, which is often read out of context with 13. You say they need to be read side by side. Why so?
Indeed. Well, just as any letter that you got a hold of that was written to my wife, and if you spliced and excised this and that, it wouldn't do justice to my intent. In the same way, when we read epistolary literature, we want to do that. Contextually, the end of 12 hangs together with 13, and I like the way you framed that. What do we find at the end of chapter 12? Paul offers proscriptions of taking justice into one's hands. Let's call it, for the sake, lack of a better description, vigilante justice. What is being proscribed? Vengeance is mine, says the Lord, and here he quotes from the Pentateuch, I will repay. And he proscribes people, individuals, taking justice into their own hands. So justice in that private or individual or personal context, such as we find in, say, Sermon on the Mount, is disallowed. It's disavowed. It's proscribed. However, immediately on the heels of that is a prescribing of justice. Whereas it's proscribed in the hands of us as individual people, it is prescribed, it's permitted, it's instituted, yes, it's appointed by God in the hands of the magistrate or the governing authorities. And for many of us contemporaries, we find Paul's view of the magistrate extremely uncritical, don't we? We think, you know, why isn't he more critical of the state? After all, totalitarian governments would take advantage of Matthew 13. And so what strikes us as a very uncritical, sympathetic view of the authorities here is simply Paul's theological explanation that there is a proper context for justice. And so the sword, the jus gladii, the sword of the magistrate is used to and is wielded by him, by them, not by private citizenry, rather by the governing magistrate in order to protect the social good. And then at the end of that, 13:10, he brings in the idea of love again. So he began the context of that literary unit with love, the end of chapter 12, and then he ends it here midway through chapter 13 with love again. And so, indeed, justice and love hang together and are two sides of the same ethical coin and are not set in opposition to one another.
So then, with this foundation laid, how would you describe the classical formulation of just war theory?
Well, the just war theory is not some sort of exact, precise calculus that fits neatly without our agonizing over its implication. I just want to say that a justified war is really a comparative and not an absolute account of justice. And so there's this messy middle between pacifism and, shall we say, jihad or militarism that calls us to wrestle with the application of moral criteria. What are the moral criteria that really constitute the just war tradition? Three of these constitute whether or not to go or enter into conflict. Traditionally, they were developed most extensively by Thomas Aquinas: just cause, right intention, and then legitimate political authority. That would be the jus ad bellum, or justice in going to war. And then there are two classical criteria that guide us once we're in conflict, jus in bello. These would be discrimination and proportionality. Just perhaps a comment about each of those. Just cause would raise questions such as this: does it address a wrong or oppressive injustice existing? Have there been grave violations of human rights or crimes against humanity? Do certain wrongs need to be amended? Right intention would raise the question, does it seek to promote ultimate good or peace? Does going to war seek to bring about a greater good? Then thirdly, legitimate political authority. This was very important, by the way, for Thomas Aquinas because of the common nature of marauding and banditry going on in medieval culture. So the difference here would be a politically constituted authority, such as a prince or a king, over against a Robin Hood. That is, those who are entrusted with preserving the common good, as opposed to those who've taken justice into their own hands. And then once we're in conflict, the two primary criteria of discrimination and proportionality speak to very practical considerations. And we saw this in Iraq very vividly in the past months. Discrimination, that is, we do not bomb, we don't go after non-combatants, we don't go after civilians. And that's why some of the guided laser technology was so important. Obviously, one cannot prevent that absolutely, but we do not target civilians. And then proportionality simply understands that retribution is proportionate. Criminal justice system, of course, is based on that. We don't cut off the hands of people stealing cookies. Neither do we slap the wrists of those who murder in cold blood. And then there are other prudential considerations that have over the years come into this tradition, such as last resort. That is, have we exhausted all possible political and diplomatic steps to avoid conflict? And then other other minor but prudential and important considerations that also wrestle with moral legitimacy.
What additional challenges? And this is the second to last question, so if you could be brief, what additional challenges does terrorism, that entity, bring to the whole application of just war theory?
Well, you brought up the distinction, Todd, between Romans 12 and 13. That is, the idea of taking justice into one hands as opposed to properly constituted legal authority. It seems to me that's where terrorism is illegitimate. The very character of terrorism is such that it takes justice into its own hands. It violates national territorial sovereignty, doesn't it? It promotes disturbance and chaos rather than peace, and it deliberately goes after innocence. It deliberately uses disproportionate means, and it has no value that it places upon human life. All those belong to the moral criteria that we just noted, didn't we? So the principles, it seems to me, the principles of just war tradition constituting the backbone of Christian thinking are helpful for us in dealing with what I would call the morally abominable nature of terrorism. And terrorism is not new, let me say. Yes, it has a new packaging, it has a new context. But, for example, medieval banditry and marauding were common, and for that reason Aquinas devoted so much of just war thinking to these criteria of constituted authority, just cause and right intention. And it seems to me the analogies between our criminal justice system and dealing with terrorism are useful. The same criteria govern both. And we don't just stand back on the one hand and allow crime to happen. And neither do we go in and firebomb a whole city just to get one one criminal. Rather, the answer is a balance in that messy middle. How do we apply just criteria in a way that avoids the two extremes that I mentioned?
With only 1 minute, no more, what conclusions would you draw about the present war in Iraq as you look at it in light of just war theory?
Well, in 1 minute, multiple considerations, Todd. There's been a lot of dispute over last resort, you know, probably more dispute over that. You know, have we done everything we could? Are there more diplomatic or non-lethal options? But it seems to me that there is a word of wisdom and caution that we find in the Catholic Catechism. I cite the Catholic Catechism, excuse me. I'm an evangelical Protestant, but I'm so appreciative of Catholic social thinking. The Catholic Catechism, when it's dealing with just war criteria, has this to say, and I find it very helpful. The evaluation of just war criteria belongs to the prudential judgment of those entrusted with governing and protecting the common good. That is to say, Todd, because the Church does not participate in diplomacy or intelligence gathering and the like, she's not in a position to establish last resort. So in the end, I think the Church should be involved in moral discourse. We should be involved in the national debate over whether or whether not. But in the end, we need to allow that to rest. We need to allow those political authorities to establish last resort and then rest in that. And in my view, there's a history behind the whole Iraq situation that speaks to the justness of the cause that goes back 25 years and even to the prior war.
Dr. Daryl Charles, our time is up. Thank you very much for being our guest on Issues Etc. Give our best to Frank Beckwith.
Hey, we'll do that. Thank you. It's been a joy being with you.
Dr. Daryl Charles, visiting fellow at the Institute for Faith and Learning at Baylor University. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.